Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Shamla Sailish and I will be reading Smithsonian Magazine here on Sight into Sound Radio. Today I will be continuing with the article The Art of the Scam by Jordan Michael Smith. According to McDermott, the men sold fakes online to collectors, dealers, and auction houses. Indeed, it was Voss who had supplied the auction house outside Toronto with the fakes that aroused Morisseau's attention in 2001. McDermott dropped the claim for unknown reasons, and his representatives did not respond to numerous requests for comment. But other auctioneers, collectors, and buyers began looking to the courts to adjudicate their disputes as well. One of them was a rock star. Kevin Hearn plays keyboards for the band Bare Naked Ladies, best known in the United States for the 1998 mega hit One Week and for writing the theme song for the sitcom The Big Bang Theory. The band has sold more than 15 million records, and its success allowed Hearn to get serious about art collecting. He had long appreciated indigenous art and was moved that Morisseau spoke of using his painting as a way of healing others. In 2005, Hearn purchased a Morisseau painting called Spirit Energy of Mother Earth for $20,000 from a Toronto gallery that assured him it wasn't one of those frauds Hearn had heard rumors about. In fact, 2 years earlier, Morisseau had sent the gallery a letter informing it that several of its Morisseaus were fake. In 2010, Hearn lent the canvas to the Art Gallery of Ontario for a show he also helped curate. Days later, he received a call saying that the gallery's head curator had ordered the painting removed. It was a fake. A soft-spoken and unassuming man, Hearn says his heart sank at the news. He felt personally violated and angry that Morisseau was being exploited. He sued the gallery in 2012 and together with his lawyers spent the next several years investigating Voss and Lamont as the ringleaders of a wide-ranging scam. Between 2012 and 2015, Hearn practically became a part-time private investigator as he and his lawyers interviewed more than 200 people, primarily around Thunder Bay, including associates of Voss and Lamont, other buyers who thought they had been duped, and Morisseau's close friends and family members. They learned that Lamont and Voss, white men both, claimed to know Morisseau. Lamont's father had been friends with Morisseau, and the artist had even given him several original paintings. In a court filing, Voss said that he too had met Morisseau at a friend's place in Thunder Bay in the 1980s, and that he began purchasing authentic paintings from friends who lived in or near reserves. Hearn's investigative team found that for years, Lamont and his wife had helped oversee a group home for Indigenous youth. Dallas Thompson, the Anishinaabe man who knew a Morisseau relative, said Lamont operated the home as a virtual factory for producing fake Morisseau paintings. Under Lamont's direction, youths and other Indigenous people in Thunder Bay were paid or forced at threat of violence to create Morisseau lookalikes by the hundreds. Then Thompson, Voss, and Lamont put them up for sale on eBay or drove across Canada, selling them to auctioneers and dealers for resale. Thompson, who says he gathered the courage to speak against Lamont years after being assaulted by him, told me that he alone witnessed or participated in the creation of at least 400 Morisot fakes. At a hearing during his lawsuit against the gallery, which began in October 2017, Hearn supplied experts who testified that the painting he'd been sold was a fraud. Thompson testified as well. But the defense offered countervailing evidence, including a handwriting expert who testified that, in his opinion, the signature on the painting was almost certainly Morisot's, which caused doubt in the judge's eyes. The burden was on Hearn, as a plaintiff, to prove that the painting was a fake. And according to the judge, Hearn didn't have the proof. In his 2018 decision, the judge acknowledged that a fraud ring existed in Thunder Bay, but he said the ring's existence didn't prove the individual painting. Hearn's purchase was a fake. It was merely contested. The judge granted that Hearn and his experts might be right, but said they might be wrong too, and the truth is not always attainable in the layperson's sense. He concluded that a tie goes to the defendants. Stymied by the courts, Hearn continued to pursue his cause outside of them. He contacted an old friend, a filmmaker named Jamie Kastner, who did his own reporting and put the results in a 2019 documentary under the ironic title, "There Are No Fakes." The film brought to a larger audience the bewildering saga of the Morisot hoaxes, the various lawsuits, and the allegations involving Voss and Lamont. "There Are No Fakes" was powerful, thorough, and persuasive, but it received little notice outside the province of Ontario. Fortunately, one unlikely viewer knew all about Voss and Lamont, and he saw in the film's evidence a way to finally take them down. Jason Ryback, 48, has been a cop since 2000 and is only 6 years away from retirement. We met on an August morning in 2023. Ryback has a shaved head and neat facial hair and wore a blue suit, a pink shirt, and a tie. After stopping at a Tim Hortons drive-thru for a cup of tea and touring Thunder Bay's rough spots in his car, blasting rock music, we made our way to the provincial police station. Until 2019, Ryback knew little of Morisot. After all, he works murders, not paintings. In fact, it was a decades-old homicide that brought the Morisot fix to his attention. A cold case from the mid-1980s, when a 17-year-old named Scott Dow was murdered in Thunder Bay. None other than Gary Lamont had been a prime target of the investigation, but police lacked evidence to charge him and the case remained unsolved. Ryback stayed in touch with Dove's mother, however, and she suggested that he watch a documentary that mentioned her son. Ryback watched "There Are No Fakes" in late 2019. Afterward, he says, "I started looking into it, hoping that this would lead us to solve the murder of Scott Day. But it never really went down that trail. It went right into this fraud." The first phone call Ryback made was to Hearn, whose lawyers provided Ryback with information about Lamont and Voss, and the numerous court battles involving Hearn, McDermott and other buyers, collectors, and gallery owners meant extensive documents were available online, leaving Ryback a list of interview sources. With the Thunder Bay Police Service understaffed and focused on safeguarding an infamously troubled city, Ryback called in the provincial police for additional resources. He also contacted the FBI's art crime team to help local law enforcement learn how to structure the investigation and which experts to consult in distinguishing between authentic Morisots and lookalikes. Instead of investigating the sellers of Morisot fix, as the RCMP had done, Rybak focused on the forgers, beginning with people like Thompson. He also zeroed in on buyers who seemed to know who had been paid or approached to make fakes, where the art supplies were purchased, and how the paintings were sold. To Rybak's surprise, he had little trouble loosening tongues. While some buyers were embarrassed they had been hoodwinked, they generally weren't cagey, unlike most of his interviewees in homicide investigations. It was weird because everyone we dealt with liked us and was forthcoming, Rybak says. And some of them openly pointed to Lamont and Voss as the main culprits behind the scheme. More challenging was determining whether auctioneers, gallery owners, buyers, and even the painters for hire themselves had participated knowingly in the scam or simply been paid to paint without knowing the works were being advertised as Morisot originals. Complicating matters, Rybak says, was that the courts had mistakenly ruled that certain fakes were authentic, which collectors, gallery owners, and sellers sometimes pointed to in legitimizing their fakes. Eventually, Rybak figured the best way forward was to reconstruct Morisot's nomadic life, like a biographer interviewing anyone the painter had encountered. He learned that Morisot couldn't have pumped out the prints in the 1970s and 1980s that certain galleries and owners were claiming because during these years he wasn't working much, or when he was painting in a different style. The cops became de facto art critics and historians, able to discern between Morisot's distinct techniques during different periods in his life. Soon, they were able to spot fakes from the real thing. They are noticeably different, except for a few, Rybak says. Some paintings were listed as having been painted by him after 2007. But Morisot didn't paint a lot when he was dead, Rybak says. You are listening to Smithsonian Magazine on Sight into Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight into Sound on HD4 on 88.7 KUHF, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as your smart speaker. You can also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight into Sound Radio since 1967. Rybak determined that Voss hatched the plan around 1996, forging paintings and selling and consigning them before amassing a team to produce fakes across Ontario and Alberta. When Rybak interviewed Voss's ex-wife, he recalls, she said she'd been waiting for 25 years for police to arrive at her door. Rybak concluded that by 2002, Lamont, who Rybak says may have been comrades with Voss in the drug underworld, borrowed the idea for himself and started a second ring doing the same thing. Lamont had photos of himself with Morisot on his website, which may have calmed the nerves of prospective buyers. Lamont sold the paintings online to people all over the world, which significantly expanded the operation. Another acquaintance of Lamont and Voss, who remains unnamed by police, because he died before he could be criminally charged, had passed information about the scam to people in southern Ontario, which led to a third fraud ring that appeared around 2008, generating yet more fake art. For years, Ryback says, these three overlapping rings manufactured perhaps tens of thousands of fakes and spread them around the globe, generating tens of millions of dollars for themselves, auctioneers, and gallery owners. Ryback established that there was an entire Morisot industry, one that earned into the nine figures, and Norwell Morisot never profited a nickel from it. Tracking down every forgery was impossible. There were simply too many already out there. In late 2019, Thunder Bay police raided 100 works from Lamont's Thunder Bay house, then found another stash in Voss's home nearby. In 2022, Ryback led a haul in Calgary that netted yet another 300. Enough that a 24-foot van wasn't big enough to carry them all, and he had to locate a larger truck. At each location, Ryback and his colleagues discovered assembly lines of people had been producing Morisot lookalikes. Ryback found that top art institutions had fallen for the scam. In court, collectors pointed to these institutions as proof that disputed Morisots were indeed authentic. According to Ryback, the Canadian Senate building had a fake, and he believes that at least one of the 23 Morisot paintings and prints held by the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian is a fake. There is no one straightforward way to go about answering a question about authentication. Gwen Manty, a conservator at the Smithsonian American Art Museum, told me, Manty herself is one of a half dozen painting conservators at the institution, part of whose job includes researching and vetting newly accessioned objects. She explained that the Smithsonian asks its donors about the provenance of the works it receives, and the institution does not believe the donor of the Morisot collection had reason to doubt their authenticity. None of the questioned Morisots are on display at Smithsonian museums, since proving their actual provenance is extremely difficult. Rachel Shabika, supervisory register at the National Museum of American Indian, said, I would imagine that most large museums have collections of things that they are not 100% sure about, particularly as an institution that's as old as the Smithsonian. There had been no immediate plans to display the disputed painting before the Smithsonian got wind of these allegations in 2019. Ultimately, Ryback's investigation took 2.5 years and involved nearly 100 law enforcement officials who interviewed more than 270 people. In March 2023, he and other officials in Thunder Bay announced that they had arrested 8 people at the center of the fraud rings. Among the culprits were Lamont and Voss. Police filed 40 charges, among them forgery, fraud, and possessing stolen property with the intent of selling it. In the backdrop, at the press conference announcing the charges, were 10 of the more than 1,000 forged Morisots police had seized so far. the precise number of total fakes manufactured over the years is unknown, but could be more than 10,000, Rybak says, with the criminal profits amounting up to $100 million. In December 2023, Lamont pled guilty to one count of forgery and one count of defrauding the public above $5,000. And he was sentenced to 5 years in prison. In response, one indigenous leader said the forgeries had criminally exploited First Nations artists and threatened to delegitimize the culture further. At his sentencing hearing, Lamont said that he was very sorry and remorseful of what I have done and take full responsibility. Rybak expects the plea to be the first of many. Trials for Voss and the other suspects are scheduled to begin this year and next. Voss has been averse to talking with reporters and couldn't be reached for comment. Hearn, the collector whose initiative helped investigators get to the bottom of the scam, believes that Morisot's identity as a part of a marginalized group was helpful to the crooks. The success of the fraud ring, he says, illustrates the perpetuation of the problem with the relationship between indigenous people and colonizers. The fraudsters were betting on a lack of outrage when Morisot's reputation was tarnished. Rybak agrees and adds that the scammers were aware that Morisot never kept a resume of painting. The forgers knew there was no way, in their view, that anybody would ever be able to figure out what he actually painted. Meanwhile, Rybak and Hearn say that prospective buyers regularly call or email asking for guidance in authenticating this or that painting, worried they may have sunk large sums of money on worthless imitations. Some buyers were built out of their life savings. For the fraudsters, of course, the scheme was nothing more than a way to make money. But the devastation to honest buyers, to Morisot and his legacy, to indigenous culture, and to Canadian art writ large is incalculable. Morisot's works were not meaningless paintings, but precious, irreplaceable examples of the Anishinaabe experience in Canada and the world. As Thompson told me, every painting is supposed to be an insight into my culture. While we have come to the end of our program, I have been reading Smithsonian Magazine. I'm Shamla Sailish, and this has been a production of Sight into Sound Radio, Houston, Texas.